This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Hello, middle-level educators. Are you looking for a nationwide type of conference at the fraction of the cost? The North Carolina Association for Middle-Level Education welcomes you to Charlotte, North Carolina, March 24th through the 26th for the 2024 NCMLE Inspire Conference. My name is David James, NCMLE Marketing and Conference Director, and I want to personally invite you to our annual conference. You will not want to miss our keynote and featured speakers that lead over 100 middle-level specific teaching and learning sessions. Our featured lineup includes EDU experts from across the country, such as principal and leadership expert Baruti Kafele, Darren Peppard, LaQuanta Nelson, Zach Bauermaster, and the host of this podcast, Mr. Charles Williams. The NCMLE Inspire Conference is for everyone. Go to ncmle.org to register your team for the 2024 NCMLE Inspire Conference today.
Welcome to the Counter Narrative Podcast, a show designed to change the way we talk and think about education. By sharing stories of successes and triumphs, we aim to challenge the dominant narrative that often negatively portrays our disenfranchised populations. I'm your host, Charles Williams, an urban educator for more than 15 years, a current school principal in Chicago, an educational consultant, an equity advocate, and the co-host of Inside the Principal's Office. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Counter Narrative Podcast. As always, thank you so much for jumping in and taking a listen. If this is your first time in the space, welcome. I am guaranteed that you will enjoy this conversation. So make sure that you check out some of the other episodes. And if you are returning, thank you so much for rejoining. You will not be disappointed, as I have an amazing guest on for today's episode. I first met this person this past fall. We were actually in the airport together, flying into the same exact conference, happened to recognize that we were both there. And then, you know, we just met up, two strangers on a plane. Sounds like a start to a strange rom-com, but this was just having some fun at a conference down in Kansas. So Joe Brummer is in the space with us today. Joe, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good for the beginning of the year. And it's been nice holidays. And so I'm kind of edging to get back to reality. Feeling good.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's that weird time, right? Like things are slowing down after the holidays. We're ready, right? Ramping back up. So we're kind of in that little lull space and as everything's kind of revving and ramping up. So I'm excited to see what you have coming up this year. Any exciting projects?
Oh my gosh. So this year is going to be, I think this year is going to be pretty amazing for me. Aside from having a lot of travel and a lot of conferences to speak at, I have a brand new book popping out in June, and so I'm excited about that. It's co-authored with Margaret Thorsborn, who folks who might be in the restorative justice world know that name of Margaret Thorsborn. She's a pioneer of this work for the last 30 years. And so to get to co-author a book with her is phenomenal. And then with her, I'm going to co-present a masterclass and a keynote at the Trauma Aware Schools Conference in Brisbane, Australia. And so I'm feeling like it's going to be a really good year of you know, getting to travel and go places that, you know, I normally wouldn't get to go and then drop a brand new book. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, it does sound like 2024 is going to be phenomenal for you. So let's back up for a minute. So you are clearly an author. You're clearly speaking. You mentioned restorative justice practice. So let's tell the audience just a little bit about who you are, the work that you do. I know that when you and I were standing in line for our rushed lunch at that taco joint, I was learning a little more about you. And one of the things that you said was like, you know, unlike most of us in that space, you're like, I'm not your traditional educator, right? You took a different pathway. So tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and the work that you do.
So yeah, so I got into this work sort of on this bizarre path that I didn't expect to take, didn't plan. It's like how many of us have careers that we just landed in? And for me, I just sort of landed here. And it started off, I was working in mental health as a assistant training director, putting together trainings and doing some training on my own as well. But I also had this side interest in mediation and conflict resolution. And so I went and became a volunteer mediator for a mediation center, volunteering a lot in small claims court. And eventually they introduced me to restorative justice to do victim offender mediation, mostly for juveniles who've been first time arrests. Hmm. And so I got trained in restorative justice. This is going back a good 15 years. And so I got a job at a community mediation center as an associate director. And part of my job was to go into schools and do professional development for teachers, as well as set up peer mediation programs with kids, and then train children in peer mediation, which was nothing I'd ever done before in my life. I'd never worked with kids, had no idea what to expect, but pretty quickly figured out I really like this. This is, you know, I wasn't one of those people that was used to being around kids. And so that was super new to me. But it just seemed like they're little people and it all worked. Like, we're all people, we'll figure it out. And so I've had a blast learning about that. But as I went into schools just kept bringing me back. And so eventually, unfortunately, the restorative justice programs that we had here in Connecticut were killed by our governor, a few governors back. And so there was no more funding for my position. And I had a school that I'd been working with that said, well, can we just start paying you? And I was like, oh, all right.
Sure.
And so the next thing you know, the principal of that school went to a different school and brought me there. So now I'm in two schools. And then the assistant principal goes to another school. Now I'm in three schools. And here it is, you know, since 2015 till now, what is that, 7 years or something? Now I'm in schools, I'm at conferences, I've written a book. It just sort of exploded. And most of this was partly my obsession with peace and nonviolence. And that stems from being a child abuse survivor, from being a hate crime survivor, and just not really liking violence. I don't have a use for this. And so I started studying a lot of things around peace building and restorative justice and trauma-informed principles seemed to fit right in with peace building, but I didn't see other people doing that. And the restorative justice world is sort of oblivious, you know, on some levels around trauma-informed care. And so I've been determined for the past couple of years to try to bring these concepts together, which there are, you know, a small number of people trying to do, but a lot of people still believe that restorative justice work is inherently trauma-informed, and it's just simply not. And, you know, there are big reasons for that I'm sure we're going to talk about today, but the biggest one being behaviorism. You know, if you're circling kids up or doing restorative chats, but you still believe that kid made a poor choice, well, then you don't understand the brain and you don't understand trauma-informed care. And so we got to change that. Like, that's a big thing to change, that we have to stop seeing kids' behavior through this lens of carrots and sticks and behaviorism and outdated ways of thinking about behavior when we now have the neuroscience to tell us that stuff isn't really as accurate as we once thought. And it changes how you interact and do interventions to help kids be their best self and to meet expectations. But it's got to be done through this neuroscience lens and not this, you know, 100-year-old outdated science of carrots and sticks. And so that's really like how I got here and what I feel passionate about doing is giving people new tools and tricks to stop seeing things through that behavioristic lens and responding through that lens.
So Joe, I appreciate you bringing this up, and I think it's a perfect segue. I know that you and I chatted briefly about this. You know, I mentioned to you that we pride ourselves on having a restorative justice space within our building. And then, you know, we started talking and I was like, maybe I should not have said that out loud to you. Because you're right. You know, there are some things that we latch onto and we pride ourselves. And I don't just mean, you know, me and my school, but I think we as educators and we pride ourselves on doing this work. But we have to understand that we exist in this kind of ever evolving space as we continue to grow and learn, right? We have to also be willing to evolve our practices and not just sit in that space of being prideful to say, no, I'm an expert, this works, but to always be asking, can it be better, right? And I think if anybody has ever followed you on social media, seen any of the things that you have put out there, this is definitely one of the things that you talk about is this idea around like behavioral approaches. And so I think that would be a good place to jump in because you're right. Like the idea of the carrot and the stick, right? There, even with restorative justice practices, there's a lot of pushback saying it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And I'm wondering, does it not work when it's partially implemented? Right. And so can we dive into this a little bit more to say like, what is it that's happening within our schools and like, why is this a problem?
I mean, if you go back, you could go all the way back to Ronald Reagan, right? If I was going to take some stuff from Bettina Love, right? In her book, Punished for Dreaming, she talks about how these problems really started in Ronald Reagan's sort of no to drugs thing, where we started criminalizing children's behavior. And it's easy to criminalize behavior in children if you see that as choices. But around the same time, around early 1990s, we saw the coming, you know, what George Bush at the time called the decade of the brain. We saw this swell of neuroscience information come out because of the invention in the early 90s of the fMRI machine. Well, while our schools are off, you know, still doing this old school 1950s B.F. Skinner stuff and Watson and ABA, neuroscience was coming along in the 90s and 2000s and saying, this brain doesn't work like we thought it did. And it works in a way that behaviorism becomes outdated. But our schools at the time, especially from around 1999, No Child Left Behind, the Safer Schools Act, we put into place all of these things that are almost counterintuitive to what the neuroscience tells us. So we pushed out things like PBIS, super problematic, super inequitable stuff. And we think that it quote unquote works because it gets us compliance. These are simply compliance-based models that get kids to do what you want them to do, but not because they see or understand the reasoning. They just do it because they don't want to get in trouble or they want to get behavior bucks. And so we've pushed this so deeply over the last 20 years and expanded these programs that we've made school. And then now we're teaching to the test. We're cramming so much into the day with a curriculum specialist like grilling everyone to make sure that you're on the right page and the right chapter by the right date. School's no longer fun. Like what kid? I know kids that don't, I had one fifth grader, and this is really recently, one of the fifth graders in a school I worked in said that he never has happy thoughts during the day.
That is extremely sad.
It was painful to hear. And this kid was really like, I could see his agitation and his just anger in his face. He's just stewing in his classroom. And it's really because everybody's just telling him what to do and trying to make him meet the expectations. But if all we're doing is feeding them expectations, at what point does learning lose all its charm, lose all its fun? The learning should be the reward. And I'm lucky that, you know, at 50-some years old, not giving away that number, but at 50-some years old, you know, I love to learn and no one's ever killed that for me. But I also didn't do traditional school for my degree. I don't even think twice about getting a master's because as much as I love one for the learning, it's not like I'm going to get a raise or make more money. And so learning's just fun for me, But then when I look at the kids I work with in schools, learning is just a job. Learning is something that we've done to them instead of doing it with them. And so it's taking all the charm out. And now we have kids, we have school refusals at an all-time high. Now add to that, that this culture and climate that we've built for children in our country is just ridiculously unhealthy for kids. School start times are problematic. Like, kids are not getting enough sleep. Their nervous systems are rattled all the time because they're not getting the right nutrition. And so you end up with kids that are just, their mental health is trash. Like, the reports that are coming out in the last 10 years, and then more so recently, are just showing us that the mental health of children is tanking. Prescriptions for children using antipsychotics or psychotropic medications have tripled and doubled. Hospital room visits for mental health problems in children have doubled and tripled. And this was prior to the pandemic. And then the pandemic came along and kicked everybody's butts a little further. And so now what you hear in schools right now is that we got to come down hard on kids because their behavior has gotten really bad. Mm-hmm. And what we're blaming is the discipline. We're blaming trauma-informed. We're blaming restorative justice because we don't want to look at the fact we've set up school to just be trauma-inducing instead of trauma-informed. And so until we address the mental health of both educators and children, this isn't going to get better. And so there has to be a wake-up call that says we have to start taking care of educators so they have the nervous system to take care of kids. And then we got to start changing our systems to be trauma-informed and neuroscience-informed, developmentally informed, and stop it with the behaviorism carrots and sticks. And that's just not where we are. I'll tell you a story from, we were just both in Kansas, and mm-hmm. one of the educators we were with out there had a student in their school, lost both parents to COVID, and was then put into the foster care system, had like 6 placements in 1 year. Behavior problems started rising in school, no surprise there. And so they do an FBA, a functional behavioral assessment, you know, that document that takes all the child's behaviors and narrows them down to like 4 categories, 5 mm-hmm. categories, mm-hmm. depending on which one you're using. And they discover that he's quote unquote work avoidant. And I'm thinking to myself, what, how low on the planet's like totem pole do you have to go to think that a child that's just lost everything wants to just get out of math? Like, how much of your humanity do you have to lose to see a suffering child and say, it just doesn't want to work? That's where we are right now. And we wonder why the behavior of our kids in schools is so bad. And it's not the kids that have changed. It's these ridiculous discipline programs that we've put into place. And you're right about restorative justice and trauma-informed principles. If they are not done with fidelity, if they are not really implemented with full force, you don't get the benefits. You might see a little bit of benefit, but most of the time what I see in schools is punitive systems made pretty so they look restorative. But there are very, very few schools across the country that are really implementing this work with the fidelity they need to see these benefits. The schools that are doing it with fidelity are seeing amazing results, you know, and people are like, show me those schools and email me. I'll send you to them. I don't know that the schools themselves want me to do that. But I mean, I've seen these schools. I know they exist. And I think we just need to somehow have a wake up call to get people to see that this PBIS stuff, this, many of these discipline programs that we've put out there are steeped in Skinner and Watson, ABA, functional behavioral assessments, BIP plans that are not, they're not neuroscience informed. And most of those interventions, I'll tell you this part. Here's why those interventions rarely work on the kids we need them to work on. Because all of those interventions are cortical. They demand that the child be in a reasoning part of their brain. But children, one, don't have a cortex that is fully developed. So being in that reasoning part of the brain is tough. And even when they are there, it's not developed. The other part of it is that our text, the part of our brain that does reasoning and learning, is state dependent. The more stressed out we are and the more dysregulated our nervous system, the less access we have to that part of our mind and our brain. All of the interventions from ABA are cortical. They require the child to make choices. But if they're not in the part of their brain that makes choices, they're not going to make the right one because they can't. And then who do we blame? We blame the kid for not trying hard enough. What if the behavior is stemming from the environment? What if it's being triggered off by a smell? What if the colors and sensory information in the room are overwhelming the nervous system? Like, we don't take into account any, and all of those ABA things look mostly at the child, and they don't look at the environment. They don't look at the teacher. They don't address things like having a white teacher when you're a black kid and feeling misunderstood by that teacher. Like the racism that lives in schools, the homophobia. We're not taking into account all the outside factors that an FBA is not going to look at.
So, Joe, you've made some bold claims, right? And I appreciate it. I mean, this is the space to do that. You know, especially the idea that, you know, instead of being trauma-informed spaces, we're trauma-inducing, right? And as I'm listening to you, I go back to one of the statements that you made at the beginning, that it's easy to criminalize, right, these types of behaviors if we view them as choices. And as you just explained, right, just biologically, right, the research has shown, like, that is not something that's always happening, rarely happening, because of various, right, whether it's maturity, right, brain development, whether it's stress or trauma, whether it's a combination of these things. And yet, these are the practices, these are the systems that we have in place. Now, I'll be honest, right, I just sent an email this morning as a follow-up for our PBIS store to be restocked. I'm like, hey, where are we at with this stuff, right? Like, so it is a common practice within our educational spaces. And so I'm curious, in your experience and in the work that you're doing, despite all the research, and we love in this field of education to say we are research-based decision-making, right? So despite the fact that there's a ton of research that says, hey, look, these practices that are extremely popular, that are prevalent within our spaces, A, are not working, and B, can actually be causing some of the exact trauma and harm that we're trying to avoid to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. Thus perpetuating the spaces, the issues that we're experiencing. Why are these practices still so common in our schools, despite all of this research saying stop doing them and let's take a different approach?
I think, you know, my first answer would be that it's a lack of knowledge about, you know, we're still teaching behaviorism in most teacher prep programs, where we could be teaching neuroscience of behavior. So right there's one little switch we could make that would make a huge difference. But I think, you know, we've invested so much in this belief system. And as a culture, we're really steeped in it. You know, even your workplace is steeped in behaviorism. You get an oral warning, a written warning, and then you get fired, right? It's all based on the idea that people's behavior is just simply, you know, top-down behavior, right? So it's coming from the cortex, and that's what's making all the decisions for your body. But that's not how it works. And so schools, literally, you know, the government itself in many places has established that PBIS is the way to go, except PBIS is highly problematic. And by the way, it's not as evidence-based as people think. There's not that much evidence around PBIS that is solidly peer reviewed. And like granted, there's a little bit out there, but if you look at things like self-determination theory, if you look at the neuroscience, your mind starts to change about how effective PBIS, responsive classroom, lots of these, you know, compliance-based models. And what happens with that is, you know, I'll bring up that next big topic in the world, is that a lot of those things actually dysregulate the nervous system further than leading to seclusion and restraint, which I can tell you right now, one of the most traumatizing things you could do to a child is seclusion and restraint. And so, but how commonplace is it? And in many states, it's extremely commonplace because there's no laws. Other places are starting to ban seclusion and restraint, or at least ban seclusion. Good love for them to ban restraint. But I've had teachers argue with me in schools across the country that they need restraints or, so that kids don't hurt themselves. But I'm like, I think people like Ross Green, Dr. Bruce Perry, Mona Delahook, like we have all of these neuroscientists and behavior experts telling us that you can avoid restraint. You can avoid seclusions. Just stop using this carrot and stick stuff. And unfortunately, our schools are just so invested in PBIS, responsive classroom, and these sort of compliance-based models. They don't want to, and they also believe in it. You know, I have a couple ABA friends who are, you know, the BCBAs, and they all swear by their work. Yet in one of my school systems, we had a kid that was being restrained multiple times a day, every day for like months. And then he comes back to school the next day like it didn't happen the day before. And then you wonder, it's probably going to happen again. But everything they were using on him were sticker charts, behavior plans, and all stuff that required that kid to do all the work, but required no one else to do anything. Well, then when the kid didn't do what he was supposed to do, you start, you know, it's eventually going to frustrate the kid. The kid feels like, and this is true of a lot of kids, all the kids that get the rewards and the behavior bucks, great. It works for them, but they probably didn't need it. To the kids that couldn't earn that because they didn't build that executive function yet, they're basically being punished by not being rewarded for skills they simply just haven't developed the brain function to have. You're punishing them for developmentally being behind. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But here we are.
Wow.
Doing our best to change it.
Joe, you know, as you're talking, right, I'm both trying to think, like, what is the follow-up question to keep the conversation going, but also, like, engaging in this reflection to say, Charles, what are some of these things that you're doing in your building right now that are possibly, right, contributing? Because what I'm hearing is, yeah, well, we need restraint. Well, you need those things because of the systems and structures that are leading to the behavior that's causing you to have the restraint, right? If you change that, right, if you change those pieces, then maybe, right, you wouldn't need that. And when I was asking earlier about why are we engaging in these practices, and I think, again, what I see a lot, and even in the other work that I do, is it's a lot easier to engage in kind of that discourse one, right, to say, well, it's them, right? The student is the problem. They're making poor choices. If only they, if only they, if only they. Whereas earlier you alluded to the fact that maybe we need to do some self-reflection, right? And ask ourselves, are we, right, as staff, the school, the space, contributing, you know, to these behaviors? And I know sitting in a conversation with my grandson in kindergarten, right? And Guy, a future guest on this show, definitely talking about seclusion and restraint. There should be no reason why you ever restrain a kindergartner, right? And so obviously when I sat in that meeting for my grandson, I had a whole different perception, right? A whole different perspective and having that conversation. And I remember calling out the teacher and saying, well, what is it that you're doing? And the shock from the teacher, the aghast from the principal, how dare you accuse us, right? But I think when you're engaged in that part, so I'm curious, that was my experience as an educator. And I'm guessing there's a lot of people who listen to the show, right? All like 12 of them, who, you know, being in schools, they might be listening to this right now and saying, Joe, you don't get it, right? It's easy for you, as a person not in schools constantly, as a person who's not always with a student, who's not sitting in a space with a child for 6 to 8 hours a day, whatever it may be, to then say, well, you don't need to restrain a child. But when this child is running around and they're hitting people, or they're trying to hit the teacher, or they're going to hurt themselves, then what, Joe? Tell me what. So what? How would you respond to the people who are just so frustrated, who say, that's not true, you don't get it, I'm the one in the classroom, I'm in that space, this is the reality of our situation?
I would tell them that if they want to do the work, they can have a restraint and seclusion-free school. And I know that because I have a school like right here in New Britain, Connecticut. We have a school, and I won't name them directly, but a school that I worked with this teacher when they were with Hartford Public Schools. She was an assistant principal. Then she got into New Britain and she became principal. And the first thing she did was start implementing, you know, the things I'd taught her before. And then as an educator, she knew how to apply them in a better ways than I could even imagine. And they took that school's, you know, seclusion and restraint down to nothing. Nothing. There are no restraints being used in that school. They had kids, they were using them before. Now they just don't need them. We tend to think of school when it comes to behavior. And just for the record, I've spent lots of time in the same schools with the same kids for, you know, a year or two at a time. And so I have been there with those kids that we think we need to restrain. And I've seen how teachers have shifted away from that and built the relationships to where that kid feels safe and regulated. If you recognize that that child is getting dysregulated before that it gets bad, then you won't need restraints. Mm-hmm. Because you'll put in things that have put in place that calm the nervous system back down. And so when a child is dysregulated, that's when they're going to tear up your classroom. How about, you know, don't wait till they're dysregulated. How about we put regulating things for all students throughout the day? And so things that are patterned, repetitive, and rhythmic. So let's bring in exercises, activities, both physical, breathing, mindfulness. You can bring in things that if you put them into place at the right ways at the right time, that you have a relationship-based school that is focused on nervous system regulation, you will not need seclusion and restraint. And so to those schools that are like, we need restraint, it's because you're creating the circumstances where you need restraint. You want to get rid of it, change the circumstances, change the environment, and change the relationships you have with children so that you have a relationship-based school and that the relationships in your school are healthy ones. And that starts with the teachers. You know, I've heard Lori DeSottle say this in a keynote where she said, when she goes into a school and she sees a high referral rate, that's not a reflection of the behavior of the children. It's a reflection of the nervous states of the nervous systems of the educators. It's the adults. And you've seen that book, When the Adults Change. It's like when we can get the nervous systems of the adults to be regulated, that means they can be attuned to the kids around them. And when they're attuned, they can feel really early on, little Billy's getting a little bit, you know, dysregulated. And so right away, we can get Billy moving. We can get Billy feeling good. We can make them feel safe and welcome and they feel like they belong. And then suddenly that what could have been an explosion of behavior dissipates. You know, we set up calming wellness centers in our schools, whether it's a wellness corner or a wellness center or a peace corner, whatever you want to call, you know, a de-escalation space or a re-regulation space. I know Meg Baldwin's school calls it the reset and return room, where children go, they get their nervous systems taken care of, and they get back to class so they can learn. If you put the right stuff in place, you won't need seclusion and restraint. And when you do talk to Guy Stevens from the Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint, he will tell you exactly the same things. I mean, so you'll get to hear it, and he's way more articulate about it than I am. So, you know, I think he's amazing at describing how these systems work. But even some of the top people like CPI, that, you know, the Crisis Prevention Institute, who teaches, you know, restraints, also says you can reduce restraints by doing all these other relational things, all these other safety things, all these other things in your school that focus on nervous system regulation.
So much of what you said, I think, rings true when we, as listeners, pause for a moment. We remove maybe the preconceived notion about what school should look like, and pause for a second to say, what could it look like, right?
Right.
What are some of the things that are happening within our schools that are preventing us from being where we want to be? And as you've already mentioned, a lot of what we are doing has not changed for generations, right? School, for the most part, despite all the new technology and all the fancy things, right, for the most part at its core is the same. And so despite a very, very changing world around us, as you mentioned, the, you know, just the trauma inducing spaces that exists within our spaces, right? And whether that's within our home, within the environment, I mean, again, we just went through a pandemic, which we're still seeing the outcomes and experiences of. And so for the listeners who are sitting in the space, who were able to pause judgment, or maybe they paused the episode, right, regulated themselves, came back to the episode, who said, all right, Joe, I hear you, and I'm curious, like, what can I do? Maybe we're talking about large scale systems and structures and things like that, and I'm not in a space maybe to change that, but what can I do within my own classroom, within my own school, that I could begin maybe changing some of those practices to have more of a trauma-informed, a trauma-responsive, right, space, to where it's not driven by compliance, right, and not so determined on choice, but to better understand, right, the outcomes, the behaviors of the students, and addressing them appropriately.
Yeah. That's a great segue into like helping me talk about my new book.
Well, there you go. See?
And so the way Marg and I really, you know, framed this book is that we see this trauma-informed restorative journey as that, a journey, right? And it has really sort of, you know, three big elements to it. It's a personal journey. Like, you have to admit that in order to be trauma-informed, you've got to befriend your own nervous system and be aware of your own trauma. And you got to work on it. You know, if the kids in your classroom are pushing your buttons and you haven't worked on changing that, yeah, there's a problem there. So we got to admit that it takes some honesty and it takes a personal journey. And with that personal journey, it means reading the books on trauma-informed, watching the webinars, doing the TED Talks. you got to do the work and be responsible for your own learning to change your classroom. And so my first thing is like, go out there and start reading, watching some Bruce Perry videos on the Insights for Educators. I think those are a great start for folks. But then you got to go to the second part of the journey. This isn't just a personal journey, it's a professional journey. You got to start applying this trauma-informed knowledge into your classroom. And every classroom is different. And so it's got to be tailored to your classroom and the relationships you have with your kids, your fellow teachers, your administrator, your parents and families, and start realizing that we need to be trauma-informed with parents in the same way we need to be trauma-informed with kids. You know, you think about parent-teacher conferences. If a parent comes into a school building, which we both know, right? We work in education. Schools have a smell. Like, I don't know how you describe it to people, but if you don't work in education and you don't regularly go into schools, that smell is sort of a mixture of like strange kid body odor, cafeteria food, and something that smells something like disinfectant. It's just, schools have this very interesting smell. But then imagine you're a 40-year-old parent walking back into a school building after really not being in one, smelling that smell, and now you're in sixth grade again. And this educator that educates your kid is telling you all this stuff about your kid, and you're hearing none of it because you're already back in sixth grade getting in trouble for something. Like, we forget that we have to be trauma-informed professionally for our parents, for our fellow educators, all of whom can have their own triggers. So we have this professional journey of learning and recognizing our own nervous systems. Then we have this professional journey of applying that learning in school with both our kids, our coworkers, and the parents that we work with. Then there's that third layer. This is a social justice journey. You can't be part of systems that are trauma-inducing and call yourself trauma-informed. So now we got to start thinking systemically. How do we change the systems so that they're not traumatizing brown and black children, Indigenous children, gay LGBTQ children? Like, I don't see why it's so complicated to find a bathroom for a kid to be in. This is not rocket science. Like, we have to find ways to do social justice work in places where kids feel, you know, welcome. And if you go back to that sequence of engagement from Dr. Bruce Perry, which we've all heard a million times, regulate, relate, reason. If that kid's not regulated and they don't feel like they belong, they can't learn. And so we on a social justice level, we got three journeys here. We got a personal journey, a professional journey, and a social justice journey. And as educators, or just as human, I believe, working in any field that involves children or other humans, we need to start putting this trauma-informed lens on. And there are places trying to do that, like in Hull in England, in the UK, they're trying to make it a trauma-informed city. Like, and so they're trying to make sure everybody, the police are trained, the hospital care workers are trained, the educators are trained, daycare workers are trained. Everybody's coming from that lens of trauma-informed. It's possible we could do this. And the change you would make in the world would be phenomenal. But at this point, it's not optional because our kids are not doing okay. Like the mental health of children is pretty trashed right now. And so, you know, we have this screen time thing going where kids have lost all their social engagement skills because they're doing everything online. And that screen world is in social media, all that, you know, the dopamine rush. Children are getting screens much too early, missing monumental developmental milestones like serve and return. Then you add on to that this lack of trust in institutions between, schools are no longer trusted on the goodwill, like the social contracts that we're making aren't holding anymore. And so there used to be a so-called social contracts that we assume a school is going to teach our children. But now we all these people are saying, well, schools can't be trusted. We have to ban books and we have to watch what they're doing. And suddenly schools are no longer a trusted institution, as well as journalism and our elected officials and corporations. We've lost the social contracts that give us trust in our society. And our kids are reflecting that at us, right? And then lastly, there's this argument between individualism and collectivism. And that's where those breakdown of social contracts exist, that, you know, we are just in a space where we're putting so much emphasis on individualism that we are no longer have social contracts that say, you know, if I take care of my neighbors will take care of me. But now it's like, you know, all about me, just me, 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 me. And we don't care about anybody else. We saw that in the pandemic. You know, we saw lots of people who said, I don't care if other people get sick or not. I only care about me. Well, that's problematic. Like our society doesn't work that way. And if you look at these changes, they're within the last few hundred years. But human beings we've been around for 250,000. And the human brain has not evolved to deal with these issues. And so now this is causing problems. And the only way we're going to fix that is if we sort of take on this journey to trauma-informed and restorative. It's almost a return to where we used to be as humans. When you look at like indigenous culture, hunter-gatherer culture, this is how human beings have functioned for thousands and thousands of years. These changes into like behaviorism, praising children like crazy, overscheduling children like crazy, this is all new, and it's not healthy for children. And so we got to start changing our systems. All right, I'll get off my soapbox.
Joe, no, I love it. I appreciate it. I'm curious. You know, it's just there's definitely some more conversations here, and I think this will definitely there'll be a part two. You know, and it's always interesting, I find, when things continue to resonate, right? I was just having a conversation, you know, with Charlie Peck, and we were talking about that, you know, the overscheduling of children, and you referenced Meg, who will also be on the show, and it's just I'm wondering if maybe there is this beginnings of a counter movement who are beginning to say, you know what? We've come a long way, right? In this vein of advancement and innovation and all of whatever we want to label it, but starting to see the detriments and the problems. And I know personally, this is something that even in this upcoming year, has been one of my dedications, not 2024, the year of more, but actually the year of less. Like, let's scale things back. Let's focus on the humanity, those connections, the being with one another. And so I'm glad that you brought a lot of this up. I hope that I will continue to do this work within my own school, that clearly there's some continued shifts and practices. And I know I will definitely be reaching out and tapping into your expertise. But for those listening who are like, man, I can see why he's done this work. I can see why he's in these schools and you know, making some phenomenal shifts and impacts in those spaces. How can they find you? Where can they link up with you? Where can they maybe find the new book or the book that you already have? You know, push it out there. How can they connect?
So the books are both available. You can pre-order the new book, which is called Becoming a Trauma-Informed Restorative Educator, co-authored by myself and Margaret Thorsborn. The first book is also on Amazon, Becoming a Trauma-Informed Restorative School. Marg also was the editor on that one, so that she's definitely got her fingers in how I write books. And then you can always look me up on my website, which is joebrummer.com. I'm on Facebook as Joe Brummer, Twitter at Joe Brummer. And so you can always find me on social media. I am trying to cut back on my social media use. So if you get there and you don't see me posting a lot, you know, trying to do my best at stopping that phone addiction that some of us at my age have, that dopamine addiction. But yeah, you can always find me online. And my email is really easy. It's just joe@joebrummer.com. And people are welcome to just pop me an email. I really try to like hold some space for educators that, you know, if you have questions, you need resources, you read my book and you want something, you know, just email me. It might take me some time to get back to you, but I promise you I will. And it's so much better when you send it to my email, because at this point in time, I'm sure that you have the same thing, is that people message you on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and then you're like, I don't even remember how they got me.
Like, which, and you're bouncing which, around trying to find it.
Yeah. Like, I know it's somewhere. And I even get random text messages from people I don't know, you know, asking me questions about education, which is funny. But yeah, you can, any of those places, I'm always happy to like help people and support educators in taking this journey. I think we could change the world if we just get more people on board. And I think it's a growing movement. You look at the Trauma Informed Educators Network, where, you know, up to like 32,000 members. The Restorative Justice and Education Facebook page is, I think, about like 5,000 to 8,000 members. And this is a big movement. And even the Creating Trauma Sensitive Schools conference coming up in February, in Dallas with VATN, that conference, you know, pre-pandemic, we were up to like 1,200 to 1,400 people at the conference. And so it's really showing you how much people care about this, and that it's a growing movement because it's necessary. It's hope. Well, it's hope.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a message of hope. And that is a great way, as we're in the beginnings of this new year, of the hope of what can be. So I just want to say thank you, not just for being on this show, which obviously thank you for connecting. I told you I wanted to create a space. I think the work that you do is valuable. And so I just want to say thank you for that. Thank you for doing this work. Thank you for standing firm and saying, hey, these are the changes, being bold, making those bold claims and standing in that space. So that way, maybe something will actually change. So I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I want to thank you for listening to the Counter Narrative Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to like, subscribe, and of course, share it with friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show, so please leave a comment or two as well. Now, I'm not sure what platform you're using, but the show can be found on Anchor, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and plenty of other platforms. If the show isn't on your preferred site, let me know, and I'll be sure to get it up and running. This podcast is also featured on schoolrubric.com, where you can find educational articles, videos, and interviews with educators from around the globe.
Be sure to connect with me and other listeners by following the show on Twitter at the CN Podcast and joining the show's Facebook group. Take care.